And welcome back to A Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott alongside Dennis O'Hare. It's 1:32. Environmental concerns and issues in this country, Dennis, can be traced farther than one might think. In 2010, writer Jess McNally of Wired.com wrote about an event that took place on July 26 in 1943 when Los Angeles got its first big smog.
And here's what McNally wrote. In the middle of World War II, Los Angeles residents believe the Japanese are attacking them with chemical warfare. A thick fog that makes people's eyes sting and their noses run has taken hold of the city. Visibility is cut down to 3 city blocks. And remember, that was 1943.
Well, smog still continues, but it's a little bit better in some areas of the country. Fast forward to 2015, but air pollution is still one of many issues, Dennis, on the environmental hazard list. And all things environment have been a long time work for our next guest, Laura Turner-Seidel, chairperson of the Captain Planet Foundation, which promotes hands-on environmental education projects all over the world.
And in 2004, she co-founded Mothers and Others for Clean Air. She's currently the chair of the board. And in 1994, she and her husband co-founded Chattahoochee Riverkeeper, which is very involved even to this day.
And Laura joins us now in our Closer Look studios. Thank you so much for coming in.
It is great to be here, Rose and Dennis. Thank you for having me.
You know, there was this Gallup poll that was conducted between 1997 and 2008. These were the top 5 environmental issues that Americans said they were most concerned about: contamination of drinking water, water pollution, soil contamination, wildlife conservation, and air pollution. So my first question would be, you still think that number one, contamination of drinking water, still the average American is most concerned about, you still think? That was from 2007 1997 to 2008.
I think so. We started the Chattahoochee Riverkeeper 20 years ago, and it was basically because we had serious pollution in our waterways here in Georgia and on the Chattahoochee River, partially treated sewage after every rainstorm would just inundate people's basements and their yards, and then we were sending that all the way through Georgia, through Alabama, all the way to Apalachicola Bay in Florida. And as you know, now there's a Supreme Court case that has been filed and accepted that will be, you know, everybody's gearing up for right now. So it's going to set important national precedent, I believe.
So how would you assess, I mean, 2 decades, how would you assess, you know, where Georgia's drinking water is in terms of, if you could go, give it a, let's say a scale of 1 to 10 in terms of being, you know, pollutant free, I guess, in a sense.
Well, that, I can tell you that because of our lawsuit 20 years ago, Mayor Shirley Franklin really stepped up to the plate and raised the money. It was like $3.7 million to upgrade and retrofit Atlanta's aging sewer system.
Because the city was being fined under Mayor Campbell, and he just kept saying, we'll just pay the fines and not really coming up with a solution.
The Clean Water Act infractions, yes. And because of that, our waterways are about 90% cleaner, the tributaries for the Chattahoochee River. So, you know, we've come a whole heck of a long way, but now that there's some issues centered around additional permits for companies and cities to put pollutants back into the waterways. And so that's all kind of happening right now. Those, I believe the public comment is open until the end of the month.
Yeah, that's where I was going. The state has granted, there's a new round of sewer permits for Metro Atlanta. Will this, do you think, mean the standards will drop for clean water? Or is this a sign, actually, that the cities and the jurisdictions who are getting these permits actually know how to better control what goes into the river in the first place?
I think it's a combination of both. But in Atlanta and around the state of Georgia, there's a very powerful water coalition, and there are a lot of you know, scientific
experts. They're at the Capitol today, in fact.
Yes, that are weighing in on this issue, and I think that 20 years ago you'd be hard pressed to have all the science lined up. But we have some real strong voices that are stepping up to the table and will help you know, get the right thing done as far as legislation and the water permits go. And I think that that's absolutely key, that these scientific voices and all the research is part of the equation. And I think now, because of the work of a lot of nonprofits like the Chattahoochee Riverkeeper, the voices will be heard.
Is the biggest problem with clean water, and we always used to hear that, there are these big plants dumping, this plant over here or that is dumping stuff into the river. But over the years, one of the big things we learned was it's what they called non-point sources, where it was just all of the rest of us in ones and twos that actually accounted for most of the pollution. Is that still true?
Well, a lot of it was related to our sewers and the overflows, and it wasn't point source per se. But a lot of it has to do with agriculture and runoff from our lawns. All the phosphates and the chemicals that we use on our lawns is a big problem, too.
So right now we have, and we talked about it in the last hour, the issue of whether the Soil and Water Conservation Commission of the state would retain its funding and its independence. Does it matter where that monitoring comes from? Does, say an agriculture department, where they're thinking of putting it, would that be okay to do the job, or do you still need that independent body?
Well, I can say from the Chattahoochee Riverkeeper perspective, we are doing a lot of our own monitoring, of what's going on in the waterways, because the Department of Natural Resources has, those budgets have been cut severely. And so it's really important that the nonprofit community steps up to the plate and make sure that the water quality sampling is going on. And Adopt-A-Stream is a very important part of that as well.
We're talking about, keeping environmental issues, on the political landscape. I want to shift to another population that you've been involved with. It's with our youth. It's with education and the importance of having environmental curriculum and education for students, because if they learn at a young age on the importance of whether it's just recycling or understanding how to keep the earth green. You've been very instrumental with, of course, the Captain Planet Foundation, but talk a little bit about how that's going in terms of the education. Are you seeing how the education with kids and an environment has really been successful and critical in keeping, the future Laura Turner Seidel, who's going to be doing this work when we're long gone?
Well, I think my generation and perhaps some of the younger generations that are here in the room with us had the opportunity to be in the outdoors, whether they were parks or camping, hiking, Girl Scouts, Boy Scouts, what have you. But now there's a new term coined by Richard Louv called nature deficit disorder. You can read about it in the book Last Child in the Woods. And it's really where kids are spending so much time either indoors or in front of some kind of screen, like 8 to 10 hours a day. And it's really tough for kids to get over their fear of nature. Dirt, germs, bugs, eating vegetables, snakes, the biodiversity that we share the planet with. And they can't really connect up with the life support system, the air, the water, the importance of that healthy soil, if they're indoors and in front of some kind of screen. So it's really important that, and through the Captain Planet Foundation, through our small grants program, we've gotten millions of children involved in hands-on learning projects. And that's the way you can really teach a child about how important those issues are, in a very positive, hands-on way.
And so if you can't get the kids out into nature, I always went to summer camp and people have been scouting and things like that. So if you can't get kids out into nature, you can sort of bring nature into the classroom and sort of teach them hands-on about that. You have an initiative with the Atlanta Public Schools as well.
That's right. School gardens for us has been really important, and we've We've actually supported about 750 school gardens around the country, but then we went back to do an assessment and we found out a lot of those gardens had gone fallow. And it was because the gardens weren't enculturated. So we figured out a program, and we call it Project Learning Garden, where we enculturate the gardens. So standards-based curriculum where kids can learn all their core subjects in the context of the garden. Mobile kitchen carts, so what they grow in the garden can be brought into the classroom and tasted and cooked, and the kids love it. And then also summer garden management. So we're working with Rashid Nouri from Truly Living Well, who has young urban certified growers that actually come to the garden, and all that food. We managed 60 gardens last year in Metro Atlanta, and 4,000 servings of vegetables went to the food bank. So this is, we've signed a contract with Atlanta Public Schools, and we'll be putting in a garden in every school, plus Atlanta, four other school districts in Atlanta. So that's a total of 525 schools, and we've got 125 in the ground.
So a garden at every school.
A garden at every school, and the kids actually get over their fear of nature really quick, and they also get over their fear of eating fruits and vegetables, which is really important because Georgia has some of the highest rates of obesity.
Obesity, yes.
Yeah.
Real quickly before we, because we're already short of time, but I wanted to get into one area in Georgia where we are certainly seeing a lot of debate, and it'll probably extend to the legislature. It's already involving our state's utility regulators. The president, the administration has proposed some new clean air rules for power plants, coal-fired power plants. The chair, one of the members, a couple of the members of the Public Service Commission have told me that, okay, those targets for the next, by 2030, are pretty unreasonable in terms of how quickly the state could meet them. And they argue the state has already made a lot of progress in emissions from coal-fired plants.
That's true. We have made a lot of progress because a lot of those egregious plants have been shut down or they've been transferred over to gas-fired
plants. So should the proposed regulations be, if not eliminate them, but tailor them to meet what states are already doing.
Right. And in 2005, that was the metrics that they're, and the air quality in 2005 was a lot worse than it is now. So it's not a big stretch for the utility companies to meet these new regulations.
So you're saying the fears are unfounded?
I think so, pretty much. Of course, there are costs, but it's because of our children's health and the health of our community that we've got to, you know, do more. And what I'm really excited about is that Georgia has one of the fastest growing solar industries in the state, and there's a House Bill 57, which is a solar finance.
It makes it easier for the average person to put solar in
on their rooftop. It helps them finance it, and I think we need more and more of these kind of innovations. And also, Atlanta is the second second highest market for plug-in electric vehicles. And then we have the Better Buildings Challenge. You know where, do you know about that?
I'm not familiar with that, but we're real short of time.
Yeah. Actually, we can get to it on the other side of this break.
Okay,
so.
We'll stick around and talk some more about, I also want to talk about the electric vehicles.
So right, absolutely. That. Well, there's more with Laura Turner Seidel after this. This is A Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott alongside Dennis O'Hare and our guest in our Closer Look studios, Laura Turner Seidel. Before we went to break, I wanted to sort of get into when you look at environmental challenges and issues facing the inner city. And one of the things that keeps coming up, obviously, other than air pollution, but the issue of landfills being so close to low income or however you want to put it, poor minority neighborhoods. What kind of work has your organization been doing to see that stops, basically?
Well, I am a huge recycler, and I really think that recycling is part of the answer because we don't want any more landfills. And in the city of Atlanta, you know, we are at pretty much capacity. And I think Mayor Reed's sustainability programs is the comprehensive recycling is a big thing, and it really adds to our economy because it creates jobs. For every job that is equated to landfilling, 10 jobs can be created for recycling. So, you know, that's a big thing. And then they just opened a recycling center for hazardous and hard to recycle waste called Charm, and it's in the city of Atlanta. So go online, check it out, take your things there. But we do have to make sure that these landfills are not leaking. Of course, it's huge for our groundwater supply and our rivers and streams. And we do have some issues. You know, there's schools on the south side of town where 50% or more of the kids have asthma because they're in transportation corridors. Diesel is very toxic for kids. The schools are on highways, and I know that the EPA has recommendations for school sidings, so we want to make sure that we're not putting schools in those areas where kids are breathing toxic air constantly. And, you know, so it's, you know, we just have to be smarter in the way we do business. And there's no reason why we can't cut back on the waste. Use less stuff that we're going to send to the landfill. And then, you know, make sure that what is we need to get rid of is either upcycled or recycled, and make sure that we have strong legislation to make sure that our landfills aren't leaking into our groundwater and surface water.
And that leads me to sort of our final questions, because someone listening may say, well, okay, Laura, how can I reduce my own, you know, carbon footprint? What can I do as just an individual, you know, beyond recycling? Because there are all these issues. And someone listening might say, well, okay, I'm recycling, but is that enough? What else can I do? Do I need to have a big barrel out there to get my rainwater? I mean, it's a good question.
Well, we got to that when we were really in the severe drought stages, you know, two of them over the past decade. And you never know when that's going to come back.
Absolutely.
Our river is only an average depth of 4 feet, and all of our water comes from basically from Lake Lanier. But as far as you know, when I was growing up as a child, my parents and grandparents led by example, and we didn't waste anything. My dad used to get super upset if we'd leave the TV on or left lights on in the room. And I believe that we've really become a society of wastefulness. You know, half of what goes to the landfill is organics. It's food. You know, we've got to get a grip on that. And so, you know, reducing energy and water use is an absolute no-brainer, and one-use throwaway plastics is a huge peeve of mine. 500 million plastic straws go to the landfill each and every day in this country, and that's something that is just an app. You know, those things we don't really have to have. We can figure other ways around it. And it's oil as the primary ingredient.
Absolutely.
So it's a waste of a valuable resource.
Speaking of oil versus something else, we've got just a couple of seconds here, but right now the legislature, today even in committees, they are looking at some bills that would either reduce, phase out, and the tax credit that folks can get for buying electric vehicles. Is that something that maybe can stand on its own right now without the tax credit? I mean, is there enough interest in the electric vehicles and the savings you can get anyway so that we don't need that incentive anymore and we can actually use the tax money in the general fund to fund programs the state needs?
I think that climate change is such an absolute urgent issue, and the smartest scientists, the majority of them around the world, have said we have got to transition away from a fossil fuel economy to a new renewable and clean energy economy. And incentives like that drive the scalability, and we've got to do everything in our power. Our kids are going to hold us accountable, and you know, when it's all said and done, you want to be able to tell them you did everything in your power. And that's just part of it, you know, making sure that our vehicles are clean and green, and I think that incentive is truly important.
So you're saying keep the tax credit for now.
Keep the tax credit by all means.
Laura Turner Seidel, thank you so much for coming in and taking the time. And I'm not going to just tell you that Dennis isn't the only one that has a lot of straws in his drawer downstairs.
Well, you have polystyrene cups. Do you know that if you pour something in polystyrene, that it leaches chemicals into your drink, so you're not supposed to use polystyrene?
Well, Laura, thanks for coming.
And, get some mugs. Yeah, mugs. Or reusable. Yeah, there you go. You got yours. And she went back and got me one. But thank you so much. Oh, yeah.
Thank
Cheers.
You.